that nighttime attack when the bear attacks the camp, it's like what we love in King Kong Lives. It's a quintessential, everything goes bananas at once, cars explode, there's bodies on fire, it's just pandemonium.
Yeah. Totally ridiculous. Yeah. Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hannon.
And we are talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
Rob?
What are you doing here?
Listen to me. This paper company, the Pitney Mills Paper Company, bought the timber rights to 100,000 acres of forest in Maine. The Indians claim the land is theirs.
I'm a doctor.
And you know how to deal with human beings. The Indians are angry, and so is the lumber company. Everybody's ready to kill each other.
People start disappearing. The Indians spread the word that they were taken by Katahdin. That's one of their legends.
I'm here to study the environment.
My people are violently ill, and this has nothing to do with alcohol. My people are fishermen. Their lives are clean.
I've seen children born dead. Born deformed.
The end of this forest is the end of my people.
Is that from Mercury?
It was created by man. And it will mindlessly, mercilessly kill every living thing it meets.
Vincent, it's good to be here with you. How are you doing?
I'm good. Actually, I had the day off of school today.
Ooh.
On September 23rd is Rosh Hashanah, and Minneapolis Public Schools gives the day off. So it's like a random four-day week for me, but that's okay. I went to the zoo with my kid.
What a beautiful day for it, too. It was kind of like cool, like in between summer-fall weather, you know? That's great. I'm glad you had a chance to do that.
Yeah, she is obsessed with gorillas, and I think it's just so coincidental. So are we, King Kong, Congo, that we yep. spent a lot of time with the gorillas, and they were funny. It's like early, we went early in the morning, and they were like just derping around.
Still trying to wake up in the morning, drinking their coffee, you know?
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. That Ada, you know, I think she's sort of like sensing your King Kong. Like we just talked about King Kong Lives in the last episode. So I feel like she knows that. She's trying to pay homage a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll get her there.
Right.
How are you doing?
Good. Good. Yeah, had a job interview today. It's kind of a crazy time to be applying to jobs right now. But yeah, applied to a job today. I'm excited that, you know, right now as we're recording this episode, it's late September. But when this episode comes out, it'll be October, best time of the year. So horror movie marathons will be taking place for the next 3 or 4 weeks. I can't wait.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff playing at the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis throughout the month of October. Maybe there's a conflict of interest here because I also volunteer for the Trilon. I feel like I should say that. But it's a great theater. And throughout the month of October, like after October 4th, when this episode will premiere, they'll be playing movies like Kuroneko, really great Japanese horror movie. Scream, Blackula, Scream, which I haven't seen, but very excited for that.
That's a sequel to Blackula.
Indeed, yeah. which, and I've actually never seen Blackula either, but this is a good reminder that I should do that at some point.
Ditto. Yep.
So I'm excited about that. Rosemary's Baby, my favorite horror movie of all time, is playing at the Trilon. And then one more movie that I want to shout out at the Heights Cinema in Minneapolis, another of my favorite theaters, The War of the Worlds from 1953, is playing there on October 16th. So those are just a couple titles. I'm sure there are some other ones that are playing in the Twin Cities as well. Or you listeners out there, wherever you live, I'm sure there are great horror movies playing. So check them out.
Honestly, now's the time, folks. I think even like big mainstream theaters are getting in the are discovering that like bringing back classics, and especially horror films for special showings, makes them money. So
yeah.
I don't know if there's an Alamo Drafthouse near you all. They always do special events. But just do a quick search, support your theaters, because they probably have some special events going on for October.
Totally. Yeah. And it's a good, like you said, good reminder, go out to your local neighborhood movie theater, whatever it is, because now is the time to get back into theaters. Let's keep movie going alive, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank all of you for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you listen. You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on our Instagram page at camp_kaiju_podcast. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. Merch is also available at campkaiju.threadless.com. You can become a patron at patreon.com/campkaiju for discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events. As always, we want to shout out our current patrons. Thank you so much to Jason, Beast Drool, Chris B., Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. We appreciate you so much. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Coming up on Camp Kaiju, next we're going back to the silent era with Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera. Right now we have slated to join us movie critic Paul McGuire Grimes. Follow him. You'll get to know him on the listeners. You'll get to know him on the Phantom episode. But he's a great dude, knows his stuff. So we're looking forward to diving into some movie history, some classic horror movie material there. Matt.
Yeah.
I pre-ordered He Who Gets Slapped.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet, though. Or have you?
I have seen it once before.
Okay.
But Flicker Alley. Are you familiar with Flicker Alley?
Yeah. Yep. Great company. Yeah.
Yeah. They just released this edition of He Who Gets Slapped. And it's gorgeous casing and slipcover. And
yeah,
it's got audio commentary, some other silent shorts from the era.
Ooh.
I think a silent cartoon. Yeah. I'm in love with this. I can't wait to watch it.
I love that movie. It's fantastic. It's one of the earliest examples of like scary clowns in movies, even though scary is not quite the right word. It's more about just a man who's like humiliated and like beaten down by life and like the toll that it takes on him. You know, it's a brutal movie, but it's also like really entertaining. There are elements of comedy in it. And that is Lon Chaney, right? If I remember right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's fantastic in it, of course.
Yeah.
Wonderful movie. Yeah.
And Victor Seastrom directed it. Who did The Phantom Carriage, which you introduced me to.
Yeah. Love that movie too.
Yeah. He Who Gets Slapped is brilliant. Horrific, funny, just like you said.
Awesome. I'm a little envious of that Blu-ray, or is it a DVD?
Oh, it's a Blu-ray. And it's going to be remastered. I can't wait. It's going to look so good. So I'm going to do a whole Lon Chaney thing with when I rewatch Phantom. Oh, that reminds me. Okay. Listeners, this is important. So, Phantom of the Opera, the release date is 1925. However, this is where, you know, over 100 years, things get a little convoluted. So, the film was re-released in 1929 with some original scenes omitted, some added. It's a different cut. However, and I'm just speaking for me, most readily available, I believe, versions of the film you'll find are the 1929 version. And if you're like me and you own, if you own like the Kino Lorber Blu-ray, it's going to have both versions on there, 25 and 29. The 1929 version is remastered. Like, that's the one that studios put their energy into. So it looks really good. It sounds really good. I have seen the 1925 version. It's not remastered. It's very poor film stock. It's a little harder to get through in that regard. So, Matt, listeners, watch whatever version you want, but just know that going into it.
That is good to know. Thank you for that. I might have to pick up that Blu-ray before I watch it myself. Yeah, I'm excited to rewatch it.
And you know what? The first time I watched Phantom of the Opera was on YouTube, and I believe it was the 29 cut. So I'll put that link in the show notes for Prophecy. And listeners, you can just follow that link if you want a little help finding the version you want to watch.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm very glad we're bringing both Lon Chaney and Silent Movies to the podcast. It's a momentous occasion.
Oh, we can't. Oh, yeah. We got to find some way to celebrate.
Yeah. It's a dumb joke. Maybe our episode will just be us silent the entire time. There will be nothing to listen to. It'll be great.
It'll be an hour and a half of music, just like orchestral music.
Sounds great. That's like that movie, the Mel Brooks movie, that's like almost all silent. Is it just called Silent Movie? What's that called?
Yeah.
But there's like one line in the movie. I don't want to ruin the joke. It's a funny movie. You should check it out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah. It's an ironic joke at the end.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Love that movie. We won't actually do that to all you listeners out there, though.
Just the Patreons.
Yeah, exactly. The special silent episode of Camp Kaiju. Man, I'm so much good stuff coming up. It's great. Good time to be a movie lover wherever you are. Fun stuff for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of which, so this episode is going to come out October 4th. So many great classic horror and monster movies came out around this time in movie history. We have a long list here of some movies that came out around this time. Do any titles on this list jump out at you, Vincent?
Yeah, actually. The Black Scorpion from 1955. Do you know that one?
No, I love the title, though.
It is right in the fad of big bug sci-fi pictures, but the special effects, so the giant scorpions are brought to life via stop motion from Willis O'Brien. So it's a late entry from him. By this point, Ray Harryhausen had certainly eclipsed him as like the master of the stop motion. But Willis O'Brien, I think, does some really good work with bringing giant scorpions to life. It's a classic creature feature that I like to talk about.
That sounds amazing. I definitely need to watch that. You've turned me on to many different kinds of movies here on the podcast, but like, you know, giant animal, like especially like ants in the movie Them and stuff like that, and scorpions in this case. Maybe my favorite new subgenre that you've kind of opened my eyes to. So thank you for that.
All right. It's an honor.
I'm excited to check that out. I will definitely have to do that. Which one am I going to call out on this list? Let's see here. Well, I mean, the first one I want to mention is The Addiction from 1995, but only because we're going to be talking about that later this season on the podcast. So I'm excited to watch that. It's by Abel Ferrara. I have not seen that yet. That's a vampire movie. Maybe I'll just call out The Old Dark House. I feel like I've mentioned that on the podcast before. It's by James Whale from 1932, maybe even earlier than that. But a really great horror comedy. I feel like it's kind of like a warm-up for Bride of Frankenstein, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. The Old Dark House is indeed set in an old dark house, and it's kind of like a parody a little bit of like haunted house stories, and it goes in like very bizarre directions from there. That's a really great movie. One that I'm due for a rewatch. I haven't seen that in a long time either, so.
Same. I think about that movie, and that's just an easy one to watch in October. Perfect, scary, cozy up under the blankets, some popcorn type of movie.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I think I just decided what my October 1st screening is going to be, The Old Dark House.
Love it.
I see that you highlighted Night of the Lepus on here too.
Oh, you could see that?
Yep. That's deserving of a shout out as well. I've never actually seen that though.
Me neither, but I know of it. Folks, it's about killer rabbits, which is right in line with prophecy. The 70s, like, was like, when I think of 70s horror movies, I think of eco-terror, nature run amok films. So that's interesting because Night of the Lepus comes out in 1972. It's about killer rabbits. But it's before Jaws, 1975. So like before Jaws, you have movies like Lepus. You have, oh, of course I'm blanking on Frogs, 1971, I think. These are going to be in the tradition of the birds, riding the coattails of that eco-horror film. But then post-Jaws, the genre like reinvents itself in the mold, like the exact mold of Spielberg's film. So then you get movies like Orca, like Prophecy, like Grizzly, like Piranha. Yeah. So it's either the birds or Jaws, but either way, the 70s has all these killer animal movies, which I love. I love talking about these.
That's a good point. Yeah. There, you know, there's a difference between pre-Jaws, like creature features, and post-Jaws for sure. And that seems like an obvious thing to say, but it's like so clear, like where that distinction is, you know?
Yeah. Cause afterwards, wow, they're like cookie cutter, beat for beat remakes of Jaws.
Right. Yeah. With some like, you know, eco-friendly themes thrown in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say, you know, wasn't like, this is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but I feel like the EPA was formed in the early 70s, right? The Environmental Protection Agency. So maybe it was just like on people's minds at that time as well, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think there was something. I mean, these are all notes I have writing down Prophecy that I think it is, especially in the beginning of this movie, it hits on the, I think, the reform-minded mentality of the 70s. Everyone was so disgruntled. The government sucked because of Vietnam and Watergate, and the economy was terrible because there was an oil crisis. And we have the creation of the EPA, of the Endangered Species Act, like all these things to preserve to conserve wild areas. And I think Prophecy is exemplary of that.
Yeah, for sure. It's a weird movie. We'll obviously talk about that coming up soon here. It has those eco-friendly themes. It's kind of a character study. It's obviously a very schlocky monster movie at the same time. There are themes of encroachment upon Native American lands and disrespect toward the Native American peoples. So yeah, lots of, you know, very 70s era themes going on here in some messy and interesting ways. You know, I'll just say that for now.
I love my movies. Messy, but interesting.
Yeah, I feel like that's what we usually go for here on Camp Kaiju. Maybe not always. Killdozer, I don't know if you would say that's interesting, but maybe it is. I don't know. I have special like animosity toward the movie Killdozer, and I don't really know why, but sorry.
You know, I always come back to Killdozer as like my litmus test. You know, is Prophecy better than Killdozer? I think it is.
In my opinion, almost everything is better than Killdozer, but you like that movie more than I did, so. So let's dive into Prophecy.
A motion picture is coming that does not cater to fantasy. You will see nature's most savage man-eating animal. By its size alone, it can overpower and devour any human. Grizzly. Over 18 feet tall, over 2,000 pounds. The largest carnivorous brown beast in the world.
Because the campers come in here, they leave food around, the bears get the smell of it, and that's it. Well, this is different. This bum's eating his victims.
Anyone is fair game. Because this grizzly preys on the easiest food of all, man. 18 feet of man-eating, gut-crunching terror. The deadliest jaws on land belong to grizzly.
Suppose nature gave a war, and everybody came. The snake, the birds, the lizards and frogs. And suppose that the polluters, the species on Earth called man, were the enemy in that war.
I still believe man is master of the world.
And then, suppose that the human race lost. Ray Milland, Sam Elliott, Joan Van Ark, Adam Rourke, Judy Bates.
What happened?
That night science made its greatest mistake.
What unknown terror was born that night? What is the terrifying mutant that strikes from behind the shroud of night? That night of the Lepus. A night of total terror, more shattering than your strangest nightmare. What caused the unnatural death, destruction, and panic? That night of the Lepus. Janet Leigh. Stuart Whitman. Rory Calhoun. And Paul Fix. Night of the Lepus. Kill one, and thousands take their place. What devil creatures growing weight and size every day are hidden behind the eyes of horror? What can stop them? Night of the Lepus from MGM.
Maybe I'll just talk about a couple of these crew members here. I'll just blaze through them real fast because they have some interesting titles on their resumes, but like I don't, you know, not a lot to say about them per se, but if you want to add anything about any of these crew members, please feel free, Vincent.
Okay.
I was directed by John Frankenheimer, kind of an inconsistent director. He made some classics early in his career, like Birdman of Alcatraz, Seconds, The Manchurian Candidate, The Train, and later in the 90s, he made the movie Ronin, which is pretty good, with some of the best car chases of all time. But Frankenheimer also directed Reindeer Games and another movie that we've talked about on the podcast already, The Island of Dr. Moreau. So hit or miss. And maybe, you know, I don't know. The early part of his career maybe is seen as better than the latter part, but maybe that's unfair.
Well, I'll tell you, this movie is better made than The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, for sure.
I think I could say that.
Yeah, and of course, The Island of Dr. Moreau had so many like production difficulties that impacted that too, you know?
Yeah.
But yes, it's absolutely more competently made than Dr. Moreau was. A low bar, perhaps. Prophecy was also written by David Seltzer. He wrote The Omen pretty shortly before Prophecy, so he was kind of riding the high of that. He also wrote some other movies like The Other Side of the Mountain, Bird on a Wire, My Giant, and Dragonfly, and wrote and directed the movie Shining Through, a war movie from the 90s. Some of those titles maybe not considered very highly, like My Giant, for example. So David Seltzer, maybe another inconsistent artist working on this movie. Cinematography on the on Prophecy is by Harry Stradling Jr. He shot some well-known movies in the 70s like Little Big Man, McHugh, Rooster Cogburn, and Convoy, the latter of which was directed by Sam Peckinpah, but is generally not seen as very good. Music is by Leonard Rosenman. I was surprised by some of the great movies Rosenman did the music for and won some Oscars for them as well, like East of Eden, Rebel Without a Cause, Barry Lyndon, several of the Planet of the Apes movies, and then some weird outliers like RoboCop 2 and Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home. So these filmographies are all over the place for these guys. One last example here. The editing is by Tom Rolfe, another very accomplished crew member. He edited films for directors like Martin Scorsese, such as Taxi Driver and New York, New York. He worked with Paul Schrader on Blue Collar and Hardcore, Michael Cimino on the movie Heaven's Gate, Ridley Scott on the movie Black Rain, and Michael Mann on the classic action movie Heat. So wow. Some pretty, yeah, accomplished titles for the crew members in this list.
I'll say. I'm going to keep coming back to how I perceive Prophecy to be rather well made. At least better than I thought. It's the bear costume notwithstanding, this movie I can take seriously, actually, because I noticed the music and I didn't know anything about Leonard Rosenman, but I thought this music is effectively underscoring or setting the, you know, the atmosphere. So I find that pretty interesting.
For sure. Yeah. I feel like I have good and bad things to say about the formal style of this movie. For me, generally, I think it works better towards the beginning. The beginning's really striking, and I was kind of engaged in the movie right off the bat. And then there are some things later on, aside from the bear costume, that like maybe don't work for me very well. But I'll get more into that later.
Okay. Sounds like we're actually running parallel on this. It sounds like we're not too diametrically opposed.
So far. Yeah. We'll see if that continues to be the case, though.
Okay.
I don't want to, you know, spoil the lead or whatever right away.
Yeah.
But yeah, similarly, I feel like the cast is kind of a strange hodgepodge in this movie. Do you want to talk about any of the cast members?
Sure. We have Robert Foxworth as Dr. Bob Verne. He was a longtime TV and film actor, and he plays our lead male in Prophecy. Joining him is co-star and everyone's favorite star of the Rocky series, Talia Shire. She plays Maggie Verne, Bob's wife. She was a member, is a member, she's still with us. She is a member of the Coppola family, Francis Ford's sister. I always forget that. I always forget she's a Coppola.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Big family.
Yeah. And Nick Cage, too.
Yep. Yep. Giovanni Ribisi, I think, is as well. Some others. Yeah.
Crazy. Well, Talia Shire is here. She was well known at this point for her appearances in The Godfather and Rocky. She also appeared in The Dunwich Horror in 1970 and Old Boyfriends in 1979. She was nominated for the Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actress and Best Actress, respectively, for The Godfather Part 2 and Rocky.
Nice.
God, I need to revisit Part 2 of The Godfather. It's been a long time.
Yeah, for me too. And the Rocky movies. It's been a very long time for me, but yeah, I mean, it's the 50th anniversary of the first Rocky, I think, or was it 76? It's right around there anyway, so good time to revisit.
I think it nice, won yes, but, yeah. Best Picture that year over Jaws.
Right, yeah, that makes sense, yeah. Good reminder that I have to watch those movies. I also want to shout out Old Boyfriends real quick. That's written by Paul Schrader and directed by Joan Tewksbury, I think is her name. It's a really good kind of romantic comedy drama, and Talia Shire is fantastic in it, so I wanted to shout out that movie as well.
Nice. Yeah. Maybe I'll check that out. Joining both Talia Shire and Robert Foxworth is our third big actor in this movie, Armand Asante. Armand Asante plays the Native American activist John Hawks. However, Asante is not Native American. He is Irish Italian, and he, you know, Matt, as you rightly say, not a good look. but maybe best known, Armand Asante is for playing Gotti in the 1996 film of the same name. Also appeared in bombs like Judge Dredd, Striptease, and Fatal Instinct. I will say Armand Asante, I think, gives a very, I think he's very good in this movie. I think he's very committed. That's the word. He's very committed and plays it sincerely.
Yeah.
His casting, however, is not a good look.
Right. And, you know, that's the, you know, this movie was made in 1979 when that was probably, I mean, certainly less of a consideration for filmmakers and producers than it is now. It's obviously a good thing that, like, we're paying more attention to representation and the actors that are playing those roles nowadays. But yeah, maybe they didn't even consider that at the time, you know, which is a shame.
Right. And then rounding out our selected cast here that we're going to play. Oh, is the monster Kevin Peter Hall. Yes, he was a 7'2" actor. He also played the Predator in the first two movies of that series and Harry in Harry and the Hendersons. Yeah, I didn't know Kevin Peter Hall was in this movie.
Yeah, he's great. I like him. I love Harry and the Hendersons. We have to talk about that movie at some point as well.
Yeah, and more Predator movies too, because
yeah,
I mean, these are iconic roles that you have to credit the actor in the suit for bringing to life.
Totally, yeah. You do that a lot with the, you know, Godzilla and other kaiju movies, like shouting out the actors who are in the suits. And I think that's great. Like, you know, most people don't really know their names or maybe even really pay a lot of attention to the actors, but they do a lot of great work.
Yeah. Good job, Kevin Peter Hall.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, look, even though everybody ridicules the monster in this movie, it's not Kevin Peter Hall's fault, you know?
Yeah, that's where my mind was going. Like, he could have been directed better. Like, everything around the portrayal of this monster should have been tighter.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Which we'll talk about in a moment here with the production of this movie. So the screenwriter, David Seltzer, he based the story partly on a real life tragedy that took place in 1958 in the Japanese city of Minamata. At that time, in Minamata, mercury waste was dumped into a nearby river from a chemical plant and caused severe mutations and neurological degenerations among the locals, which included paralysis, you know, insanity. I forget some of the other examples that were listed there of the side effects, but really devastating. And I think I read that something like 100,000 people were affected by this. So just like an enormous tragedy in Japan at the time.
Yeah, and including pregnant women and their fetuses. So all that narrative and prophecy is ripped straight from the headlines.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, maybe it's no surprise that if that happened in 1958, and then there were, although I can't think of other specific examples, like other similar tragedies throughout the 60s, maybe no surprise that themes of, you know, toxins in the environment and corporate pollution and things like that were pervasive at the time.
Yeah. And since we're on the topic, are you familiar about the thalidomide scandal?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah. Billy Joel mentions it in We Didn't Start the Fire, Children of Thalidomide.
Mm.
But all jokes aside, this was a tranquilizer, sleeping pill sedative that was prescribed to women in the 50s and 60s. And it caused horrendous birth defects in children. And it was a huge deal. The pictures are downright heartbreaking when you look it up on Wikipedia of these children. So like that went through my mind. I've read up a lot on Larry Cohen's It's Alive.
Yeah.
Which is from the early 70s as a like that film as a metaphor for anxiety around toxins and pollutants affecting birth. And you know, women and parents not knowing, like, is my baby going to come out okay, or is it going to be a monster? Mm-hmm. So I think prophecy is also tapping into that same pool of anxiety. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there too.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And there, I guess there's the controversy around DDT too, which became a little more pronounced or more widespread in the 1960s. I know there was a book, A Silent Spring, that was kind of about that. So, you know, all these stories and all these kind of controversies coming out in the open around the same time. But you're totally right that, like, the theme of, you know, pregnancies being affected by these things, it's an emotional kind of subplot, I think, in Prophecy. A lot of the stuff in this movie is pretty silly. But I think Talia Shire's character, she's pregnant, but she doesn't initially tell her husband about that. And then when she finds out that there's this, you know, mercury poisoning in this area where they are in the movie that is affecting the wildlife, including this kind of monstrous bear creature, and that kind of adds to her emotional anxiety that she's already feeling, it's really powerful. And I think Shire does a great job of conveying that.
Yeah, agreed.
So Prophecy was filmed in British Columbia, Canada in 1978. This was actually one of the first movies that made the region very popular for film production. Ever since then, it's kind of become one of the new Hollywoods or the Canadian Hollywood. A lot of movies and TV shows have been filmed there. And Prophecy was one of the first to take advantage of that filming location and tax breaks and things of that nature. The design of the monster, here we go. We're getting into the good stuff in the movie right now. The not so good stuff, perhaps. The design of the monster went through a lot of changes in the movie. It was initially supposed to be much stranger. It was kind of meant to be like a chimera of all the different animals in the forest. So it was supposed to be this totally one-of-a-kind monster that nobody had ever seen before. And then Frankenheimer saw the initial concept, and he was like, no, it needs to look more like a bear. And that's the direction they went in, which, you know, for better or worse, it is amusing, but I feel like the initial concept probably would have been a lot scarier.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it as from a producer's point of view. I'm thinking just straight up bear is going to save me money on the production side, on the makeup side. So I don't want to say that decision was driven by money, but it could have been a motivating factor.
Yeah, I think you're totally right about that. Yeah. Yeah, so on that note, the producers tried to hire Rick Baker and Stan Winston to do the creature effects, but they were unable to do so. They eventually got Tom Berman to do the creature effects instead. You know, no shade against Tom Berman. I don't really know a lot about him, to be honest. I get the sense that like the not so great creature costume in this movie is not necessarily Berman's fault, but maybe more the overall concept and the direction they went in.
Yeah, perhaps. I'm looking him up. He worked with John Chambers on Planet of the Apes. He went on to do a lot of TV Emmy nominated work. Yeah, so he had a resume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, no shade to him.
Right.
It seems like there were other extenuating circumstances, perhaps, for this bear costume.
Yeah, right. If I can go on a brief tangent, what did you think of the effects for like the bear cubs, the babies that the monster has in this movie?
I was just thinking how those are more effective, I think. Maybe because they're smaller scale. Maybe they're probably puppets. They could be animatronic, but they're probably puppets. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think they are revolting creations of creature effects. I found myself... It was uneasy looking at them. Just like their skin is peeling off and their cries and...
They're seeing extreme close-ups.
Yeah, I thought they were done really well on a small scale. Very good.
Yeah, I thought so too. They reminded me of, you know, first of all, of It's Alive, a movie that you just mentioned, and certainly a lot of overlaps there. But the design of those cubs reminded me of Eraserhead, too, the David Lynch movie that came out 2 years before Prophecy. Of course, a very different movie. Eraserhead is just so surreal and dreamlike, like many of David Lynch's movies are. But there's like a visual similarity between the baby in Eraserhead and the bear cubs in this movie, which I doubt was intentional, but just a strange coincidence. Initially, Prophecy was much more violent than the finished cut that we got. And it actually is still pretty gory. There are some decapitations. There's some, we haven't even talked about the sleeping bag scene yet, which isn't really gory, but is like very amusing. But there's definitely some violence in this movie. Initially, though, the movie had even more scenes of gore and violence. Frankenheimer cut those out before the film was released. I've read differing stories as to whether that was Frankenheimer's own decision or if the studio kind of made him do that to try to get a PG rating and thus more ticket sales. I feel like the truth is probably somewhere in between the two.
Right. And that's a good call out. At this time in 1979, there was no PG-13.
Yep.
So you're either PG or you were R, which could be a big difference when you're talking box office. So PG, you're still probably going to get younger people, kids, come into this movie, I think that's a mistake. this movie is not family friendly. Even Jaws ostensibly is not, and yet I think it's okay in terms of the violence in Jaws.
Yeah.
But the violence in Prophecy, it's brutal at times.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are like heavy human themes in this movie too. I mean, we already talked about some of them, you know, oppression of Native American communities. Abortion is mentioned at one point and whether Talia Shire and her husband want to make that decision. So yeah, you would not think that kids who saw this movie would really get a lot out of those themes.
No, but what they will get a lot out of is a duel between a chainsaw and an axe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a strange scene. I feel like maybe we should describe that a little bit more, which I'm happy to do if you want. But yeah. So initially when the Verns go, well, maybe we should talk about the story of the movie a little bit more. So the Verns, the scientist played by Robert Foxworth and his wife, go up to Maine to investigate the disappearance of three lumberjacks. And there's this lumber mill that has recently opened in this community. And the lumber mill, like the director of the lumber mill, says that the disappearance of the lumberjacks is due to the Native Americans who live here, whose land has been intruded upon, who have been disrespected by the lumber company. But of course, the director of the lumber company is just like, oh no, they're just rowdy and violent and it's all their fault. And of course, the Native American community rightfully says this is our land and they are harming the environment. So that's like the violence and the animosity between these two communities. So this scene that you're talking about is like one of the employees for the lumber mill has a chainsaw, and then the Native American character John Hawks has an axe. And there's this duel between them almost immediately when the Verns go up to this kind of forest community. It's a strange scene. It's like an action brawl moment that almost is out of Dukes of Hazzard, but it's also like very unsettling at the same time.
Because the threat is real. Like, it wasn't played for laughs. I mean, right. It is campy just on the surface. But again, Armand DeSante is taking this very seriously. Like, nobody's has a tongue in their cheek here. Mm-hmm. And the way it's directed, you don't know if the John Hawks character is going to die or not, because he's willing to die under this chainsaw to protect the forest. So I think it's directed completely for, I don't know, seriously.
Yeah.
But it's also silly. It also scratches that 10-year-old itch that I have as a boy where I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. Let me see a chainsaw versus an axe.
Right. Yeah. And I think everything is so over the top. Well, maybe not everything, but like the political commentary is over the top in this movie. And It is meant very seriously, very earnestly, and yet there's no subtlety to it at all, and not really very much depth to it either. It's kind of just like the evil corporation against the, you know, oppressed Native Americans. And that's a worthy theme, but it's like just so like melodramatically portrayed. It does kind of come off as a little campy.
It's a pulp film, you know. You dress it up with all the talent behind the camera, in front of the camera, but like, in its DNA, this is a B movie thriller, and you're gonna get a lot of goofy moments for all the heart that it does have.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm just, you know, how weird this movie is becomes increasingly clear the more we talk about it, you know,
and the longer it goes on too. Like you said, I was with you. Like in the beginning, this movie, I'm like, all right, this is like a drama, getting to know characters, getting to know the world, the stakes. But then, yeah, by the end, you're just like all the dressing falls apart and you're just left with this bare bones story, no pun intended. it just devolves on itself. It's weird.
Yeah, it is indeed. Yeah. One possible reason for that, and the last thing I'll mention in our production backstory section here, is Frankenheimer later admitted to his biographer, Charles Champlin, that he was going through a tough period of alcoholism around this time. He said that he was drunk pretty much every day on set. Robert Foxworth, oh no, actually it was the writer, David Seltzer, who also kind of said that, like Frankenheimer was just drunk every day. And that's, you know, I mean, that's unfortunate, and I don't mean to like attribute the movie's sort of like, what's the word? I guess sloppiness. I'll just use that word again. Like for that reason, that seems a little bit insensitive to Frankenheimer, but he was maybe not going through a great period when he made this movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all of that contributed to a kind of not super successful release of this movie in 1979. It was released by Paramount in June of that year, 1 week before 20th Century Fox released Alien. So you have maybe the best monster movie of all time coming out a week after Prophecy, which is a sort of unfortunate coincidence for this movie.
And I read a lot of reviews, including Siskel and Ebert, comparing Prophecy to Alien, which is so unfortunate for Prophecy. But also, I don't think it's totally on the money.
Yeah.
Because like Ebert says, Prophecy is just, it's just Alien, but in a forest. Like, I get it, but... Also, then Jaws is just Alien is just Jaws in space. Like, we're just
right.
Like, you could play that game all day. I think what Prophecy and Alien are doing are different ultimately. But yes, they both have monsters hunting down a team of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And the similarities pretty much end there. Like, I love Alien. It's one of the best monster movies ever, of course. But like, you know, Prophecy is trying to include some social commentary and some, like, human relationships that Alien doesn't really even try to attempt. So, for me, that's the main reason that comparison is, like, not really fair to either movie, really, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe also helps to explain why this movie didn't do very well at the box office.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a stark value in, or a stark difference in value. In these two movies. Yeah, yeah.
For sure. Case in point, Prophecy made $22.7 million at the U.S. box office that didn't quite make back its budget, including its marketing budget. And it was really negatively reviewed when it came out. You already alluded to that with Roger Ebert's review. Some other critics called it trivial, an indoctrination course in liberal guilt. Other critics, which, you know, I understand what they're talking about there, although it does seem kind of unfair. Other critics complained about its cardboard characters and a story so stupid it's irresistible, which is kind of a funny quote. And the story, I don't know if the story is stupid, although its execution is kind of stupid sometimes. And stupid.
Agreed. Yeah. I'm always a fan, and I've written plays like this, of just kind of like, keep it simple. Like, you don't need to reinvent the wheel with a genre movie sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to write a movie about a group of people coming together with competing interests, but ultimately they have to overcome those differences to defeat the monster. You know, Spielberg did it with Jaws. Nobody's knocking him for his story.
Right.
So it's like, I don't know. It all comes down to execution, obviously, which I agree. Prophecy is not well executed a lot of the times, but I'm not going to knock it for just doing a classic story, as cliche as it might be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately, it's a monster movie, again, with social commentary and attempts at human drama. And like that, you know, that's a worthwhile template. Like, a lot of people have done that before. So,
yeah.
But, you know, the critics weren't the only ones who did not like this movie. Even many of the people involved with it did not like it after it came out. John Frankenheimer himself said that the potential of the project was much greater than the finished version. He admitted that he was unhappy with the way it turned out. And then the screenwriter, David Seltzer, had even more vicious things to say about it. David Seltzer later said, "It's a terrible movie. No, it really sucks. As a matter of fact, I really would like to have that remade. I was on that set," Seltzer goes on to say. "I'd even taken my kids to Vancouver, and I saw everything falling apart. When that monster showed up and was nothing but some big ballet dancer wearing huge shoes and a bear costume, I said, 'That's it,' to my kids. We're going home. That movie does not hold up." So I like that whole quote. Obviously, Seltzer is no big fan of this movie.
And I can't argue with him on that. I will say, I think this movie in retrospect has more love. It definitely has a cult classic following. I had heard about this movie. Oh, we didn't talk about our personal histories, but I had heard about this movie from a friend. It had been recommended. So I was excited when you brought it to the podcast because I finally had a reason to watch it. I think there's love for this movie out in the populace. Mm-hmm. And then I did watch a clip, an interview with Talia Shire for a recent Blu-ray edition. And she defends the movie in terms of its themes and its messaging. She's like, look, we were trying to make a movie warning mankind about the dangers of destroying the Earth. And like, the Earth Mother is going to get you in the end if you continue down this path. So that was 40 years ago. I think we're still having that conversation today. So I think that is still worthy of discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I would agree with Talia Shire on that. I also read that Quentin Tarantino kind of likes this movie as well. And he said, like, I have a soft spot for that stupid movie. Like, and he said, Shire's really great. Like, that was one of his favorite things about it. And he said that, like, the bear costume is totally ridiculous and absurd. And those are maybe the two best things about it, and the sleeping bag death scene. You're right that we didn't talk about our personal histories with the movie, and I apologize for that. But that's kind of how I learned about this movie, just by watching that YouTube clip of, I don't want to ruin it too much. Just search for Prophecy 1979. If you see anything, any titles with like sleeping bag death or sleeping bag anything, watch that clip, because it is strange, hilarious, and that's the first thing I saw from this movie. So of course I was like, oh, we have to talk about this on the podcast.
My jaw dropped. The pizza roll I had in my mouth at the time fell out when I watched that scene.
It's magical. It's really amazing. I have no idea if it's meant to be funny or not, but it is, and it's also shocking. What a moment. Yeah.
Yeah, honestly. It begs so much wonder from oneself.
Yeah. Right. With scenes like that, you can't totally hate this movie, you know? All right. Well, it's time for our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes. Vincent, do we have anything in Mina's mailbox today?
We do, and it's from a patron of ours. We'll keep it anonymous, and I will kind of paraphrase some of our supporters' email to us. But folks listening, join us over on Patreon, and a perk you get to enjoy is priority comments. And I got to tell you, we have our mailbox is overstuffed right now with mail. Our Space Amoeba episode was very popular. We got a lot of love from that. So I'm writing all these down. I'm keeping track of them. But we have to honor our patrons first and foremost. So let me just paraphrase a little bit here. Just listen to your Space Amoeba episode. You made a comment about the English dub, I hope to clarify. And we thank our listeners for helping us, because sometimes the classic kaiju films, the history, especially with the dubs and the different releases, international, Japanese, American, it can get kind of complicated sometimes. Okay, so he goes on to say, I just wanted to point out the difference in the dubs. There's a distinct difference between calling dubs English and US. Oh. Although both are English dialogue, the international dubs are almost always inferior. Something else to remember is that a dub is just another translation. Sometimes the dubs are a better translation than subtitles you get, which I think that's an interesting point. For instance, the Criterion subtitles for many of the Godzilla movies aren't that accurate. Criterion prefers brevity over accuracy. So right there, I think that's something I never even thought of, but seems to make sense to me. Yeah. Okay, goes on a little bit. One last thing I'll mention is the titles. My Doctor Who fandom kicks in here, so I tend to refer to the actual titles to define what I'm talking about. What I mean is that Space Amoeba is just the name given to the international version by Toho, and thus only refers to the international version. If you're reviewing the Japanese version, well, that is only called Gezira Ganymede's Kamibas Battle Giant Monsters of the South Seas. And the US version is Yogg Monster from Space. So our listener says, to me, that's how I refer to these Toho movies when it comes to talking about the films. He does go on to say or admit that no one thinks about all this quite as much as he does. But I love thinking about this stuff all the same. So thank you, listener, dear patron. We really value that kind of insight.
Absolutely. That's, yeah, a lot of good points. Very fascinating stuff there. And yeah, it's true. Like we, you know, I'll speak for myself, Vincent, but I try to do research and try to like track down different like versions of the movie and figure out all that backstory. But I admit it can be tough and we might be pressed for time sometimes. So we always love getting corrections and information like that. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Cause it's, to me, it's just, like getting an email like that, it adds to our conversation.
Yep.
You know, because you and I admit we don't know every in and out of these movies. So we welcome the listener feedback to add to the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just one more thing about the title, Space Amoeba is one of my favorite movie titles of all time. So I definitely appreciate the accuracy. I might continue, and this is on me. I'll probably just call it Space Amoeba just because I love that title so much. And that's,
well, you know, I think that's the default. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's great stuff. Yeah. Thanks to that patron for sending those comments.
Absolutely. And Peter Lorre. Matt, did you even notice he moved out?
You know, it's been so quiet and peaceful here. That explains it. That must be why.
Yeah. Well, now I can't sleep at night because I got some hoodlum moving in to my basement down here. It's Peter Lorre.
Oh, man. There must be a high-pitched German muttering down there all the time now.
Aid is asking me what is going on. I can only keep Lorre from her for so long.
Oh, that's terrifying.
You gave him my address.
I did no such thing. I might have given him a general direction, but, you know, some landmarks possibly. I didn't think he was even going to survive all the way over there.
Well, he did. And now I have to find accommodations for someone else in my house. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I'll offer you some tips to like make it a little bit easier. Maybe I'll give him like a parting gift, you know, since he's not in my place anymore. But yeah, good luck. That's all I can say.
I brought this on myself, but you know, we'll see. We'll make it work. We'll make it work. All right. He's gonna talk to us about a 1944 movie called The Monster Maker.
Oh, that's a good title.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst, movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances, but with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. This is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Ah! Greetings, ghouls and gals. And happy October, 'tis the gravest season of all. And thanks to Bela Lugosi for covering me last week, that man can really vamp on the mic. But now I return to continue the Poverty Row Picture Show, coming to you now from all new digs. That's right, I have left the unfriendly confines of Matthew's dirty, rotten, stinking, lousy, two-bit, flea-infested excuse for a home. And now I find myself in the basement dwellings of Vincent's own abode. What do we have here? Yes, this is good. A full liquor cabinet and a color television set. Well, I am sure that Vincent will not mind if I make myself comfy. We haven't exactly established the house rules, but, what the heck. Now, what movie are we reviewing tonight? Ah, yes, 1944's The Monster Maker. This devilish B-movie concerns a mad scientist played by J. Carroll Nash, who injects his would-be adversaries with the serum of Acromegaly. This is the disease of the elephant man, Rondo Hanton, and that scientist from Universal's Tarantula. In reality, it is a rare disorder that causes the enlargement of the face, arms, and legs. Certainly no laughing matter, and its use as a monstrous plot point in this film and others is morally dubious, even for the films of the Poverty Row. However, how does the Monster Maker stack up against others of its ilk? Well, J. Carroll Nash brings a certain Oscar-padded resume to the film, but he can only do so much as the one-note doctor. Then, would you believe there's even a killer gorilla in this one? Yes, I did not see that one coming either. What do you know, the big ape is more of a curious cameo than even a subplot. The whole film is meandering, confusing, and paced so slowly you may find yourself checking the time. Well, that's it for now, and I thank you for listening and for all the support. I think next time we will discuss my fellow horror actor, that man with the acromegaly, Rondo Hatton, in a little film called The Brute Man. Yes, well, acromegaly does factor again as a sinister storyline, but does the Brute Man out-disfigure the Monster Maker? Stay tuned to find out, and raise a glass until then to this autumnal season of Monsters and Madmen.
How do you do? My name is Alfred Hitchcock, and I would like to tell you about my forthcoming lecture. It is about the birds and their age-long relationship with man. It will be seen in theaters like this across the country. In my lecture, I hope to make you all aware of our good friends, the birds. Theirs is a noble history, and through it all, man has played a conspicuous part. This cave drawing is one of man's earliest sketches of his feathered friend. One can see at once the loving care with which the artist depicted his subject. The story of man and his friends, the birds, is filled with many fine examples of ways in which these noble creatures have added to the beauty of the world.
Back to Prophecy by John Frankenheimer. We've already talked about a number of the themes in this movie. Eco-horror probably being the number one theme in the film. Anything else you want to add about that theme in the movie?
Yeah. So we mentioned like the concept of the Earth Mother, but also that people, this is a belief, this is a I mean, at the time, I think it was radical for the Western mindset to think of human beings and nature as one and the same. And, you know, I have been exposed in my time to Native American speakers and readings that like that is a very indigenous concept that humans are not separate from the earth, that we all are part and parcel. So I think Prophecy admirably brings those themes to the surface. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really good dialogue scene between Dr. Vern, Bob Vern, and John Hawks, the Native American activist character played by Armand Asante, where you know, Bob Vern basically says, like, listen, I'm just here to check the environment. Like, I'm just, like, looking for chemicals and toxins, you know? And Hawks kind of interrupts him, and he's like, what do you mean by the environment? Like, we are part of the environment. You can't talk about the environment without talking about us. And that's like, a good point. And there's... I thought that scene was pretty believable. Not even, you know, won't talk about the acting in, or like the casting, I should say, in this particular moment. But the dialogue is really trying to get at a deeper theme than I expected in that moment.
Yeah, it was a good biting response by the character John Hawks. That was good.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, I mean, the depiction of class and the class struggle in this movie. Dr. Vern, he's treating tenement dwellers in a poor neighborhood in New York City, and he's treating a baby who's been bitten by rats.
Yeah,
and it's just heartbreaking, and it's a real baby actor, and it's just a really powerful scene of the depiction of not just poverty, but the neglect of the masses by a system that truly doesn't care about them. And if it weren't for Bob Vern, like, what would happen? Like, and so it also highlights the people who do social work, the people who are public health servants, who are willing to go into, who are willing to do really hard work that most people don't or aren't willing to do or don't even think about it. And it's not malicious. They just, I mean, if you don't live in it and you're not exposed to it and you live you know, maybe a more comfortable life, we're all guilty of it. I know there are people yeah. starving right now on the streets of Minneapolis. What am I doing about it? Nothing. But Bob Vern yeah. does in this movie, like, he's going into these places. So, like, it's the first scene of the movie, and it starts off very, it kicks this movie off into a very high gear for me.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I agree with all that. I have two responses or two thoughts about that. Well, yeah. Like, the first of which, like, the scene set in that, you know, it's referred to in the movie as a ghetto, like the New York ghetto, basically. And I appreciate the message of that scene, and I think it's, like, pretty poorly done. Like, you know, the street in front of the building where he treats that the baby and talks to the baby's mother, you know, there are, like, bombed out cars, there's stuff on fire, like, every single person on the sidewalk is, like, giving them dirty, threatening looks, and it's, like... I feel like you can tell this movie was directed by somebody who was not of this community, you know? Like, I feel like it's trying to provide shorthand as quickly as possible for, like, a crime-ridden, impoverished sort of city slum. And, like, the theme is interesting, and I do think the message is well-intentioned, but it's one of many things in this movie that I just think is poorly executed, even if, like, the idea behind it has potential, you know? And I think there's a lot to blame for that. I think it's Frankenheimer. I think it's the set design. I think it's even just, like, the editing. Because, like, you know, we see these two white men, because Bob Vern is joined by another man, like, who works for the EPA, I think. And, like, they're just, you know, it's the two of them talking, surrounded by all this, like, crime and, like, graffiti and all this stuff. So it's an interesting moment, and it kind of did also rub me the wrong way a little bit at the same time, you know?
No, I'm gonna lend credence to a critique you could read into this film, that it's, you know, a white savior narrative. I don't think that should take away from the well-meaning good work that's, you know, public health officials do, that social workers do, even if they're, you know, white people. But in this movie, especially with the dynamics between the native communities and, you know, and in this one city scene, you know, everyone's of color, everyone's, like, shooting up. It's just, yeah, it's not a scene painted by, like you said, someone who might know that kind of community more genuinely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think you could lay that critique on the film, even if it's not necessarily all there for me, but I could see it.
Totally. And I'm, you know, I agree with what you're saying. I just don't like the way it's presented in the movie, you know? But, like, that doesn't, like, totally diminish the theme or anything. It's still there in the movie, so I appreciate that about it.
Yeah, yeah. But Prophecy is it's a movie like that, though. It made me think about Orca as well. Do you remember there was a Native community in that movie, too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Portrayed by Native actors, I believe for the most part, at least the main one. But prophecy like Orca still traffics in that like mysticism around natives.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this bear, it's the embodiment of Katahdin, their forest god.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, yeah, it's still, that's problematic.
Right.
There's still a veneer of racial caricature with this film.
Absolutely, yeah. I also read that Katahdin does not exist. It was made up for the movie and is actually named after a mountain that's in Maine. I think it's in Maine. Maybe it's in British Columbia, actually. But yeah, it doesn't exist. So that part of it, and if, you know, I mean, like, artists have creative license to a certain extent, but that kind of thing is like, oh, you're kind of just making this up as you go along, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and, you know, again, like, maybe a product of its time and place. I think, like, you know, filmmakers like Frankenheimer maybe weren't thinking as much about these things as they probably should have, you know?
And then at the same time, that's why this whole conversation we're having is, I appreciate this conversation because there, to me, it's not so black and white. Because in the 70s, you also had the American Indian movement. So Native rights were a topic of discussion. They were on the front or the headlines.
Yeah.
So Prophecy and Orca, and I'm sure there are countless others, are also reflecting the times in which they're made in a positive way.
Yeah.
So
totally.
Yeah, you just kind of take it for everything.
Absolutely. The good and the bad and the ugly and the campy. Yeah, it's all there for sure.
Yeah.
In fascinating ways.
Oh, man.
You said another thing, too, though, that I picked up on and I thought was one of the more interesting themes in the movie, which is like, you know, Dr. Vern does want to do good in the world. He wants to play a positive role. He's idealistic. You know, he's not a cynic. And then, like, we, on the other hand, we get like the director of the lumber mill, who at least initially seems to be cynical and in it for the money and power hungry and all that stuff. But then there's kind of like a character dynamic where, you know, he learns like the negative effects of like his company and like he himself, like what he's done to this community and like its animals and its people and the environment itself. And like he kind of has a change of heart. And I think he shifts a little bit from cynicism to idealism. And that, I think, is a relevant theme to all of us right now. And there's like, you know, just so much right now that seems kind of tense and difficult in the world. It's like, I want to, and you said this too before, Vincent, mm-hmm. It's like, I want to make a difference, but what do I actually do, you know? And that's like a sub theme or a, like, yeah, not a subplot, but like a sub theme in the movie that I think is always relevant. And like the critic who said in their negative review that this is like coarse and liberal guilt or whatever, I don't know, it sounds kind of mean to me because that just seems like a different way of saying this movie is trying to ask, like, how do you make a difference in a world that seems, like, full of problems, basically, you know? And that, you know, like, for how silly this movie is, it does get to some of those questions, which I was surprised by.
Yeah, there's a scene in the nighttime bear attack. Everyone's hunkered down in the tunnel. And John Hawks and the leader of the, or the boss of the paper mill, like they share a look. It's a nonverbal look, but it's full of understanding. And that's when they had like you said, that white character has that change of heart. Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about deep themes of prophecy, but that bear is a metaphor for everything, all the problems, all the struggles. And, you know, we got to come together.
Yeah, really. I mean,
vanquish these monsters.
Right. It's, yeah, like it sounds like kind of hyperbolic to say that, but it's true that the movie is at least trying to wrap all that up in this movie, you know?
Yeah.
Wrap it up in a sleeping bag and then whip it with its tail into a tree. That's what it's trying to do. That's a bad metaphor. Sorry.
Into an explosion of feathers.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that also reminds me, I'm sorry I don't want to dwell too much on just this one theme because there's more to the movie, but like I read that the novelization of the film, which was also by David Seltzer, who wrote the screenplay. So he wrote the screenplay and then he wrote the novel to go along with the film to like make some extra money. But the ending of the book is even more bleak than the ending of the film, which actually isn't all that bleak. The end of the book ends with, like, the Supreme Court ruling against the Native American tribe that lives in this area and ruling with the Lumber Corporation, which, you know, is a powerful... I haven't read the book, I should admit that, but, like, it just sounds like a powerfully pessimistic and maybe more realistic way to look at the outcome of the story.
Yeah, I have thoughts about the ending of the movie. I'll get to with my bad category, actually, but, you know, we'll get there.
Yeah,
but, yeah, for thanks for sharing that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I thought so too. All right, what other themes do we have in this movie? We've talked about prejudice against the Native American communities, and like you said, Vincent, you know, it's eco-friendly themes, it's themes about preservation, and it's themes about Native American communities. There are lots of parallels between them, lots of overlaps. Is there anything else we want to say about its themes of, you know, co-opting Native American land and oppressing those communities?
I mean, always, but right. I think... Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll say one more example of how I feel like Prophecy is just such a snapshot of 70s politics. You know, abortion is talked about rather candidly in this film. And I just think that that is, I think that word and that topic is so controversial these days. And I'm not saying it wasn't then because I wasn't alive then. I don't know. But a mainstream movie, science fiction movie, is just dropping that into conversation. Like Talia Shire, the first time you meet her, she's talking to her friend about whether or not she wants to keep the baby. And I found it interesting, maybe a subversion of what I would expect. She, the woman, is hoping to keep the pregnancy. And it's the husband who would be in favor of the abortion. Mm-hmm. I just, in at least the stories I consume, those roles are usually flipped.
Right. Yeah, and that I think kind of goes back to the theme of like idealism versus cynicism a little bit, because even though the male character, Bob Vern, is like, you know, idealistic in some ways because he's trying to help the community, the, you know, primarily black community at the beginning of the film, he doesn't really want to bring new life into the world because he thinks that there are so many problems that are unfixable and like the future is going to be even darker and more difficult to deal with. And that's why he doesn't want to have a child. Like, that's an interesting dynamic, you know?
And I found that extremely relatable just personally. You know, Ellen and I had conversations like that before we decided to start a family. And I think a lot of people out there, whether you have children or not, think about it in those terms. Like, do I want to add more, another human to this godforsaken world? You know, and I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not judging anybody. It's a deeply personal conversation to have. But this movie touches on it. And I found that effective.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And maybe kind of gets to some larger themes about gender dynamics, too, not to give the movie too much credit. But, like, you know, I mean, Bob Vern doesn't really listen to his wife all that much. She numerous times tries to bring up the subject of conversation, and he just kind of ignores her and, like, tries to make out with her in one scene. And, you know, there's one moment, too, where he's fishing, and he catches a fish, and that's arguably what, like, you know... what's the word, impacts Talia Shire's baby in the movie, is eating that tainted fish or whatever. But anyway, what I'm getting at is there's a line of dialogue where he's like, oh no, actually Talia Shire says that. She's like, you fish and I'll make the food, or I'll eat the food, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a throwaway line. That's kind of about, it says a lot about their power dynamics and their views on gender and their marriage, you know?
I mean, if you really want to go into it, she's like this top flight or top tier cellist and an orchestra in New York, which, you know, okay, she's an independent woman, she has this amazing career as an artist, but she follows him to his work, and then she just, like, we never see her play the cello again. Meh, there's like one scene, but her whole character that's set up in the beginning of this movie completely fades away. Mm-hmm. And that's like a function of the script and just like how Seltzer wants to flesh out his characters. But I think it's a missed opportunity to not give her more agency in this movie. Cause I think by the time they get to the woods, she is more or less justifiably concerned about one thing only. Am I going to give birth to a monster?
Yeah.
Does she do anything more than just kind of cry about that? Not really. And, you know, maybe you could have played around with some deeper, more dynamic characterization there.
Yeah, I agree with that for sure. Yeah, I do think she plays the role very well. I think she's like pretty powerful in this movie. And like the scenes where she's cradling one of the cubs and seemingly horrified and also like very compassionate towards it in a motherly way, those are pretty devastating moments in this movie. And I was not expecting that also.
I completely agree. And then how did you feel about this moment? The bear cub like rips into her neck. It turns out.
Yeah. That's a strange moment. And also I think that's another moment that's poorly executed because you can't even really tell what's going on. There are some like close shots that are just like, you know, abruptly edited into everything else. But yeah, thematically it's like, why, I don't know, nature turning on humanity?
Or
well, yeah, like a child turning on its mother, you know? And which, of course, is her greatest fear at that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Which we see in It's Alive and, you know, The Fly touches on that with Gina Davis. So, like, we've seen that before. Ooh. I think it's always an effective metaphor, even if it's not executed maybe to the best of its ability.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a strange moment that didn't make a lot of sense to me narratively, but thematically it's pretty interesting.
100%.
Like so many other things in Prop.
And how did she not die? That thing like ripped her jugular out. Like,
yeah. I couldn't even tell who was being attacked at first. Like, I thought it was, there are several other characters that are kind of hiding out with them at that same moment. I think there's a Native American woman who's kind of joining them. And I thought that it was her that was getting attacked at first. So
yeah,
maybe. Yeah.
That's an example. I think by the end of this movie, the wheels come off, honestly. And yeah. Frankenheimer clearly might have been drunk or just didn't care. But the precision that this movie starts with is missing by the end. By the end, it is just a schlock fest. Reason be damned.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. I think one of the critics' reviews said it devolves into pure hokum, which I think is pretty accurate.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Still maybe some interesting stuff in there, though.
I loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Spoiling the ending here. Is that any other themes we want to mention? I feel like there honestly are probably more, but those are the major ones at least.
Which is very, very surprising that there are so many things packed into this little film, but I think we can end it there.
Okay. Do you think it's time for individual breakdowns? We could wrap up our formal conversation in there.
I think that'd be awesome.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk about the good, the bad, and the campy. You know, as I think we've alluded to, there is some good stuff in this movie. It's, you know, I feel like this is kind of seen as, like, ridiculous and campy and, like, just kind of so bad it's good by some people. But there's some genuinely good stuff. And I'll just say, you know, I'll start it off and then I'll turn it over to you, but I think there is an attempt to make a significant emotional movie, you know? I don't know if it totally pulls that off, but, like, it is trying to build complex characters who have very human fears and desires and, like, anxieties. And it's talking about negative forces in the real world that obviously are still with us to this day. And anytime a movie is that ambitious, I'm going to appreciate that attempt at depth and complexity.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie had a stronger impact than I ever thought it would. I just heard mutant bear movie. I said, okay, that's enough to keep me. But everything you just said is enough to, well, the schlock is getting me into the door. But what you just said is keeping me in my seat. I'm like, okay, I can sit with this movie. I can grapple with this movie. I liked a lot of choices with the camera. I like the direction. For example, the whole sequence when they are down in the tunnel hiding from the bear, this shot, this whole scene to me is the best of the movie because you have the soundtrack of the bear and men screaming. You can only hear the terror, which I find very effective. And everyone down below is as still as death. Like, they're so quiet because they're petrified, right? If you make a sound, you're dead. And Frankenheimer is visually communicating by just focusing on people's eyes, because now people are just communicating with their eyes. And there's some, like, maybe it's the diopter shot. I can't tell, or it looked like that. But I just found that scene as suspenseful as it could be in this movie, with the sounds and the lack of sounds as well. Yeah, I love that whole sequence.
Yeah, totally. I agree with that for sure. And if I can just bring up one more example of a scene that I really loved formally, it's actually just the beginning of the movie, where before the credits, all we see is like three beams of light. It's like flashlights that are being carried by the lumberjacks before they are killed by the monster. And the only thing on the soundtrack is like the sound of wind and like some of the animals in the forest. Mm. It's really creepy and minimalist. And then that cuts to like the men's corpses the following morning, and there's like classical music on the soundtrack. I was like, oh, that's a weird choice. Where is this coming from? And then it very slowly dissolves to a performance space where Talia Shire's character is playing the cello during a performance. And that whole opening is really strange and kind of like dreamlike almost. And I was like totally hooked. And then I think it does kind of go downhill from there. But that opening really grabs you.
I agree. Like, this is the John Frankenheimer of Manchurian Candidate, of all those other movies. You're like, oh, he could do it. He could elevate this movie. Mm-hmm. But then it just devolves into nonsense by the end. With that said, I love in the end sequence, it involves a lake at night, and there's a lot of fog on this lake. Yeah. I just found the whole thing visually striking and really beautiful. I was like, I love everything I'm seeing right now. And then that dumb bear costume enters.
Yeah. It could have been so great if just the monster itself was like looked a little better, you know, or a lot better.
A lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. And some other stuff. I'm sorry. I'm going to look up a character's name real quick because I can't remember what it is offhand. It has to do with that ending, though. Let's see here. Yeah, so there's another Native American character named Ramona, who's kind of John Hawk's significant other in the movie. And Ramona's grandfather, I think, Hector, is kind of along for the ride. He doesn't really have a lot to do. Maybe that's part of he might be part of the campy category for me, to be honest, which is kind of unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Played by the same actor who appears in Little Big Man. What's his name? I feel like I should call him out. George Clutezzi. Canadian First Nations actor. Anyway, like in that ending, you know, like he kind of is just like is fodder for the bear. He's killed almost immediately, but like the moment really falls flat, and it's like, oh, this could have been like a really striking moment with that atmosphere and the fog and the lake, and then, you know, it's just kind of a wasted moment. So it's like it looks great and it should be better, but it is like formally a striking scene for sure. But let's talk about the bad stuff, because obviously there's a lot of bad stuff too. And you know, you probably have to start with the bear costume, right? I mean, it's laughable in this movie.
It's confusedly so. Like, what? Why did? Who did? How did this thing pass any sort of test? Like, did the is that on the producer to say, whoa, this is not what we're gonna put on camera, right, guys? Like, it is so bad.
Yeah, it is. It should be like inexcusable. Somebody along the line should have been like, we are not doing this, you know? Yeah.
But why is it bad? Let's be clear for our listeners. Let's be good critics. Why is it bad? I think it's a poorly made rubber type suit. So when the actor inside is running, the thing just kind of flops around. It looks like it's on wheels at times, way it moves through the forest. And it could have been on wheels. I've seen that in other movies of this ilk. Yeah, it's just not a believably animalistic suit.
Yeah, and I think because it is just like a big rubber thing, like a big rubber salami, basically, you know? I think another critic used that line. But, you know, I think, like, because of that, we barely ever see, we don't really get a good look at it. Like, usually it's, like, split-second shots, or it's from the distance when it's, like, not really lit very well, you know? And obviously that makes it even worse. If you can't even see the monster, and it's like, what I see of it's bad, but I don't necessarily know what I'm seeing, that's just the worst of both worlds, you know?
Yeah. I think the scale of this creature is way off. Like, I don't understand how tall it is. Different scenes have it being the size of, like, a tree, like gargantuan. But then there are some shots. But there's so much close-ups of this thing that I don't really get a sense of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also doesn't make narrative sense, because there's a line of dialogue. I think the main character, Dr. Verne, is saying, like, you know, this seems to be an amalgamation of all the creatures in the forest, like, going through evolution at a rapid pace. But, like, sort of like a human fetus does. So that kind of brings in that theme, you know? I don't know if the science of that is accurate, but I'm not, like, I'm obviously not a doctor, so I can't speak to that. But anyway, the character is like, this creature seems to be all the animals of the forest put together, and then you see this thing, and it's just, like, a sloppy, bloody bear. It's like, what's going on here? It makes no sense.
Well, that's a holdover from the chimera idea that they had.
Yeah. But you would think then they would, like, cut that line of dialogue out or something, you know?
You would think.
Right. In a more carefully made movie.
Yeah.
I know you said you had other stuff in the bad category. What else do you have?
Well, two things. So the whole attack with the raccoon, was extremely campy. But it also made me question the treatment of animals on this movie. Like with that raccoon looked scared. Like it was in distress. And I know the 70s with these creature features didn't always have the best track record with taking care of their animals. So I want to call that out.
Yeah.
I still don't really understand why this public health worker is contacted to work for the EPA.
Yeah.
Like that just seemed like, well, we need you to do this, so we're going to do it for like the sake of the plot. But like, come on, Seltzer. Like you could have justified it a little bit more.
Yeah, why not just make him an employee for the EPA? That's like a much easier way to set it up.
Bingo, there you go.
Yeah, I thought that was weird too. With the raccoon thing, if I may, can I add something real quick? Sorry.
Yeah.
My research, I did learn that the American Humane Society did monitor like animal treatment at this time in like the late 70s, but they were not present on like every production. They just kind of had to get like, you know, paperwork and like reports and stuff like that. So I learned that like during the filming of that scene, the actor was told to like terrorize the raccoon and hit it and kill it. And like the actor at first was like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, I'm not going to kill a raccoon for this. And Frankenheimer was like, no, just like beat it up, like smash it against the wall. So like one of the crew members told the American Humane Society about this. And like somebody from the AHS did go to the set and like stopped them from killing this raccoon. From what I read, Frankenheimer wanted to throw the raccoon in the fire and kill it. And like then they had to use a dummy instead because like the AHS representative was there. So you're right to call out that scene. That was an animal clearly being mistreated. And it's a hard scene to watch.
I hate everything you just said. Thank you for sharing it. But that makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's rough.
I hate that.
That belongs in the bad category for sure. That's pretty terrible.
Oof. Different time, I suppose, but that doesn't age well, right? That's like a dated bad type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, my main criticism was with the ending of this film. I think it ends way too abruptly. We don't get any resolution, closure with the baby subplot with Talia Shire. They just take off in a plane. And yeah, spoiler alert, there's another mutant bear out there, which is where this movie has gone. Like by the end of this movie, we only care about the monster. But there's that movie from the beginning with the whole emotional roller coaster of will she keep the baby or not, that we don't get any closure on. And in a movie like this, I do need that closure. This isn't a movie where I needed an open-ended mystery. I need to know how this couple fares in the aftermath of this horrific weekend in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah, 100% agree. That to me is the most emotionally effective subplot in the movie, and it goes nowhere. You don't find out what happens with it. It's very frustrating.
Terrible.
Yeah. You do find out what happens in the novelization, but maybe I'll just, I won't go into detail about that. If anybody, I don't know who would want to read the novelization after watching this movie, but if you do want to, they wrap up that story a little bit more. Maybe I'll tell you off camera a little more about it. But
all right.
But I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that all the movie cares about at the end is the monster. And that's maybe the worst part of this movie, which is unfortunate because we're on a monster movie podcast. But, you know, like, yeah, there's a lot that's compelling and kind of admirable about this movie at first. And then it just all falls apart. And even like formally, I feel like there are way too many scenes towards the end where like it's so repetitive. It's the same thing over and over again. It's like a long, slow, silent scene where there are a bunch of close-ups of the actors, like, waiting in suspense, and then suddenly a loud musical sting, and, like, this terrible-looking bear jumps out of nowhere, and then the music's really loud and abrasive for a while, and then they escape, and then the same thing happens. It's, like, this. It's just a very poorly made movie in the end. Maybe not initially, but, like, yeah, wasted opportunity, because it could have been way better than it is.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, man. So frustrating.
Yeah.
But where this movie also like is bad, I find charmingly campy, wonderfully insane, just gonzo crazy movie making. Maybe it didn't use that term properly, but
no, I agree for sure. It is okay. Gonzo. Yeah. I mean, the sleeping bag scene, right? That's got to be campy moment number one. It's incredible.
Number one. Number one. First bear. No, well, number one is when the giant fish leaps out of the water.
Good point.
Yeah. And you it like foreshadows the effects you're going to see later in this movie. I went, oh, no. That if that's what we're in store, that's what we have in store here. This movie's not going to be what it was in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And like that happens when Bob is fishing and then they like cook and eat the fish, and it's like, dude, you just saw like a 10-foot fish jump out of the water right next to you. Maybe you should not be eating this fish right now, you know?
Yeah, that nighttime attack when the bear attacks the camp, it's like what we love in King Kong Lives. It's a quintessential everything goes bananas at once. Cars explode. There's bodies on fire. It's just pandemonium.
Yeah. Totally ridiculous. Yeah. And like it defies the laws of physics. Like a human body just like erupts into like feathers, you know? It's like so bizarre that moment.
There was that. Oh, yeah. When the bear knocks anybody, they go flying, you know, 100 yards. It's very funny. The decapitation came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Sick fact about me. I love a decapitation in a movie when it just like comes out of nowhere. And you're like, oh, that guy just lost his head.
Yeah. It's a great, reliable, gross out moment. For sure.
It's so jarring. The bear at the end goes like full like Wolf and the Three Little Pigs and just blows the house down, just knocks it to smithereens. And I'm like, oh my god, what is happening right now? It was so fun.
Yeah. That reminded me of King Kong Lives, that moment in the climax of King Kong Lives when he like rips off like the roof of the barn that they're hiding in or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It's all about connections on Camp Kaiju.
There's one more, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's with the, first of all, well, the title Prophecy, I don't understand. I could say it's a bad title because unless it's like this movie is a prophetic message about the environment, but I think it's a bad title. But what's campy about it is there's a subtitle, which is The Monster Movie. It's literally called Prophecy, The Monster Movie, as if somebody went and said, hey, we have to add this because otherwise nobody knows what it's about. So I think it's campy that it's called The Monster Movie.
Yeah. It kind of makes sense because the name Prophecy does not suggest a monster movie. So it's just like a weird conflation, you know?
Yeah, it's like a parentheses.
Yeah.
Monster movie.
Just in case you watch this movie and you're not sure what you're watching, it is indeed a monster movie.
Yeah.
All of that, obviously super, very, very campy. I briefly mentioned the Hector character before, who I think, unfortunately, I think he's the campiest example of the sort of simplistic mysticism of the movie, where he's like, you know, all God's creatures are one. I think it's something like that. And like, he doesn't really say any more than that. And it's like, oh, it's hard to know the point of that character. And then he's kind of just like suddenly killed at the end. And you're like, oh, I guess he didn't really have a point. That's not campy in like a very funny way. Like, it's more of like an unfortunate, unsettling way. But I did find that character pretty campy.
Yeah.
Yeah, like all this, like, you know, giant fish, like a giant tadpole that's the size of a frog. All that stuff is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, definitely a lot of campy, a lot of bad, and some good. So now it's time to give the movie a rating. Is it our highest rating? It's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Our third rating, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time. Tough choice. Do you want to go first? Is it all right?
I'll go first because this was your pick, so I'll give you the honors there. But
okay,
I was pleasantly taken with this film. I love a camp fest. I think this movie puts the camp in camp kaiju. So, you know, if it's ever playing at a screening, I'm there. So I think it's campy in all the best ways. But I also found it surprisingly deep in its thematic messaging. There are some bad things, especially that thing with the raccoon. So I cannot give it our highest honor. I am sorry to say. I can't do that. But I can give it our second to highest. I think there are antiquated moments in racial caricatures, in animal abuse. Those sound really terrible now that I say it out loud.
Those are bad.
Those are bad. But this movie is so dumb that it's a thrill ride for warts and all. So I think it does stand the test of time.
Nice. I love that. I wish I could give it the same rating, but I think I will give it one rating less than that. I'm not going to give it our lowest rating because there is a lot of stuff to admire about this movie, and I think it's trying, even if it doesn't succeed. So yeah, this movie may be sort of historically significant. I think it's an interesting reflection of when it was made, and it's certainly fun at times. Like, it's like you said, a total thrill ride. You never know what's going to happen next. But it is frustrating, like the wasted opportunities. I think it's ultimately pretty poorly made. I think a lot of its themes are pretty simplistic, even if I do admire what they're trying to get at. There's like not a lot of depth to them. And then, of course, just like the monster elements, the horror elements are pretty poorly done, I would say. So there's a lot that I like about this movie, but I don't think it stands the test of time. It is worth watching, though, for anybody that has not seen it.
It is so interesting. Please, folks, let us know your thoughts on this one-of-a-kind movie.
Yeah. One-of-a-kind, absolutely, yeah. This was a fun one. A lot to talk about. I'm not going to forget this movie anytime soon. Next time on Camp Kaiju, we'll be going back to the silent era and talking about Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera. Thank you again for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend, subscribe to the website, and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on Instagram. Links in the show notes. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul with Minia's Mailbox Music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
It
It's a tadpole.
I told you things grow big here.